What's going on, y'all? My name is Brady Slaybaugh, and today I want to waste no time getting into it because this story and the things he's learned along the way are incredible. So my guest today, I actually met on Clubhouse, which is an audio-only app, great for connecting with people, meeting new people. And my guest today is Carneal Griffin. He goes by Griffin, and this man has one of the best stories I have ever heard in my life. He's a guy who had everything going for him in high school. He was number two in the nation in speech and debate. Soon after, he was working for the Obama Senate campaign. And then tragedy struck in his life, and he found himself homeless, but he was able to keep that passion and purpose for life, which was able to get him through anything. And now he finds himself working in one of the most high-end industries in the world, working with the highest of net worth clients. So I don't even want to talk anymore. Let's get right into it.
You don't set out to build a wall. You don't say, I'm going to build the biggest, baddest, greatest wall that's ever been built. You don't start there. You say, I'm going to lay this brick as perfectly as a brick can be laid. There will not be one brick on the face of the earth that's going to be laid better than this brick that I'm going to lay in this next 10 minutes. Yeah. And you do that every single day.
And soon you have a wall.
All right, Griffin, welcome to the show. Dude, I've heard your story. You've told me about your story, and I'm so excited for you to get a chance to share it. There's a lot to get to, so I say we just hop right into it. You want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'm Griffin, and I am a multifaceted artist. I now specialize in luxury interior design. I have a Black-owned interior design firm and international. And so we do everything. We're full service from residential and commercial. We do the demo, the build out, and then, of course, the interior design and some other cool stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And I know, too, that's kind of where you're at right now and your current venture, but I know it took a lot to get there. So I'm pumped to dive into it and hear kind of that story. So where are you at right now? Where'd you grow up at?
I'm a Chicago native. I grew up what would be called a hybrid Chicagoan. So I was a West Sider and a South Sider equally. So for the Chicago folks listening, they'll get that.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And then what for you, would you say your childhood was like? What was most of that like for you?
Most of the childhood was good because I had strong Black women who kind of, even in their dysfunctions and struggles, they really protected and shielded me, even though I didn't understand. As I obviously, you know, as kids, I understood as a kid versus the world from an adult perspective. So, but definitely had some interesting moments throughout that journey.
That's awesome. And what, so like someone for you that kind of grew up in Chicago, maybe not the nicest part of Chicago, what were you getting involved in, like school-wise? Did you have to kind of be selective about what you were getting involved in?
Well, let me tell you this, and I think I should start the story by saying I was a gifted artistic kid. And so oftentimes when you have artistic kids, there's no rule book. You got to throw the rule book out of the window and you got to be hands-on in the moment and you're making decisions, you know, just based off of that. And so my mom had me at a very early age. She got pregnant at 14, had me at 15, and she was in the foster care system. So when my grandma, my dad's mom, found out that she was pregnant, she grabbed her and made her come live with her. So I kind of had the Cosby world on one end and then the not so Cosby world on the other end. So in that time, though, as my mom grew into an adult, because she was a kid, I was there on her side. I'm an only child. And so I picked up those adult understandings very, very early. Mixed that with an artist. Oh, you got a formula for hopefully great success.
That's awesome. So I know you got into politics early on and were kind of involved in speech and debate. How involved were you with some of those things early on?
So early on, I didn't know. I had a smart mouth, which we all know what that means. I could do the dozens with you, but it didn't necessarily have the substance. I traveled almost an hour and a half to a better funded high school, and I joined JROTC. Woohoo. And from there, I heard over the intercom one day, do you like to argue? Do you like to get your point across? If so, meet us here. And as a freshman, you hear those announcements. You're like, I heard about all these clubs. Oh, yeah, let me get to it. And I went and I saw a Smart Mouth, and it was over. So I started debating and debating in the Urban Debate League. I did really well. I learned a lot of stuff that led to opportunities volunteering through the MCFA Challenge. It's an organization here. Well, they're all over now, but they were Chicago-based only, and it was named after Abner MCFA. He was mentor to Barack Obama, President Barack Obama. He worked on the White House Council for Clinton. He was a senator, just an amazing, amazing guy. So he had this program that helped underserved communities do something in politics. And so we would get to volunteer at these offices and of different campaigns, Republican, Democrat. You could choose. They would all come and give the candidates would come to like a forum, and they would give their pitch on why you should work with them or who they are. And then this state senator dude, Barack Obama, came in, and yeah, he basically tore the house down. But there was another, Alan Keyes. Alan Keyes was a Republican candidate, and he was also brilliant. So we fast forward, I started volunteering in the office, and because I did debate, I was kind of the guy who, when the constituents call the office and say, hey, what's Obama's stance on this, I kind of knew how to find what bills he had sponsored and co-sponsored. So I became sort of a young office manager of sorts, and he was running for U.S. Senate. And in that time, he would come into the office, he'd eat pizza with us. He actually did some cool stuff, like taught us how to sign his, we would send out, I guess they were sort of thank you letters or solicitation letters for donations, because it was very, his rise was very individual donor based. That was his big thing. Like, it wasn't big corporations that he took a lot of money from. It was individual people. And yeah. So he would send out these very, you know, thank you, or please return the envelope, and you would get checks in. And so I remember he would sit down and he was showing us how to sign his signature. Those were my cool moments.
That's awesome. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, man.
That's kind of cool to hear too early on how good of a speaker he was, because that was like something that he was so good at in captivating people. Just when he talked, it was like you turn your head and you listen. What was it like early on working for Obama?
I think for us, it was normal. It wasn't special, because we knew that in order to be in this office, It was a high capacity. It was so much stuff happening, because his rise of stardom was starting to happen. And then, you know, you learn a lot. So I was able to do media training very early on. I learned about optics. You know, there were certain places that we were not allowed to, you know, patronize because of their affiliations or their ties to things. So it kind of gave me a wider spectrum. Obama just felt Midwestern. I mean, he was living in Chicago, teaching at the University of Chicago. So he just felt regular. Like, that's a person who can speak for me, because I mean, I'm a Midwesterner. So, you know, yeah. That down to earth thing is important to it was to me anyway. So he reminded me of my uncle, or if I had, you know, my ideal dad. And it was beautiful.
Did you guys ever get into it, like talking about policy or anything like that? Or was it more just kind of helping him in the office?
Well, we would do fundraisers. And so one of the fundraisers, they allowed me to introduce him, which for me now knowing, man, God's
good, dude, that's right? Awesome.
I had no clue, but I was this debater kid, and you know, I was running the office, and we got there and they're like, hey, Carneal, which is my first name. Hey, you want to introduce Obama? You're the one who knows the most about like what he's doing. This is the honest conversation. And I'm like, yeah, no prep, no speech writing, no notes, no points. And it was a private law firm. I'll never forget, private law firm fundraiser. And they had some students there. And I got up and I gave, listen, I told you who Obama was. And I remember him after that, his remarks was, man, I need to take you on the road with me.
That's hilarious. It's got the crowd going a little bit.
Yeah. So beautiful times, man.
That's awesome. So in high school, you're involved in policy and debate, speech and debate, all that kind of stuff. I know you crushed that. I mean, you probably wouldn't say it on here, but I know you were number two in the nation at that. I mean, that's unbelievable in its own right. And just even the preparation that goes into that kind of stuff is a lot. Even though you might have a smart mouth, it also takes a smart mind and a lot of preparation to be prepared for all of that. Has that preparation helped you in other facets of life?
Oh yeah, it helped me so much. So I never even filed a FAFSA. I never applied to college. I never went to an orientation. I knew right then, once my eyes were opened, we were using LexisNexis as freshmen in high school. We were talking about Nietzsche and Derrida, grad school level ideologies about politics and the world theories as sophomores. We were talking about presidential decision directives. We were talking about Ethiopia, Eritrea, border disputes, alcoholism of Native Americans for 60 minutes. And you did not know if you would be affirmative or negative until you got into the actual debate round. So I had to prepare for both sides. And it wasn't a really popular club. I'm not gonna say debate was like popular in high school. So we had sort of transient members who would come in and they wouldn't come to practice and it didn't capture them the way it had captured me. So I had to debate what was called Maverick. So generally there's two teammates on one end and then two on another. And we debate, we have these allotted times to speak. But because my school, nobody was available, I debated Maverick. So I kind of pioneered and I made it very, very far learning how to do the job of two people in a debate round for 60 minutes. Dang. And coming from an underfunded inner city school. So you had, the prep schools that they could afford to give stipends to college debaters from like Northwestern or the bigger, and those were beautiful and still are amazing debate schools. They would have them come in, make the arguments, help them, teach them, train them. And we didn't have that, but it forced me to actually have to read the entire book, which I didn't know then was, I didn't know then what that did to, for me, but now I do. I understand how arguments are formulated in context. And a lot of times when people make argumentations, they kidnap a sort of a phrase or a paragraph and morph it into whatever they want it to be. And so I was able to be more successful because I actually understood the material. Yeah.
So and I think a big skill that you got out of that too was being able to see both sides of an argument, having to prepare for both sides. And so now, whether you went down the road of politics or whatever it is in your life, you're able to more easily look at both sides, see why they're thinking the way they are, and then see why the other side thinks they're right. And so I feel like that's definitely a huge skill to have, being able to see from the other person's point of view as well.
It is when you have mentorship or discipleship as to what is happening. As I'm participating and these things are happening, I'm not listening to a podcast articulating what it is that is happening to me. So all I know is day to day, I'm just doing what I know to do. And I don't realize that there's a larger picture or that there's a plan of action that you're setting into motion now. I didn't have parents to teach me financial literacy and that, your thoughts or your creative thinking about things can be, monetized. So I was doing all of that and was home. Homeless a lot of times, sleeping in my locker cords to stay warm. I was couch surfing. So yeah, it sounds nice. It looks really great on a resume now. But then It wasn't this pretty lifetime story that you're hearing, described now.
So post high school now, you obviously had a good high school career in policy and debate and whatnot. What kind of transcribed after high school? Because I know you didn't go to college. What was the next step for you? What happened next?
I started working for the Urban Debate League, and I was doing, so I got hired now at the National Association for Urban Debate League. And so I was doing program building. So essentially what I would do is I would go to different high schools, get them to start a debate team, get the infrastructure set up. And sorry about that Sorry, I had a call come through. You know, get the infrastructure started in these different high schools and get them to start debate teams, program building. And it was amazing because I got to travel and teach other underserved high school kids how to debate, how to get their budget, how to schedule the buses and all of that stuff. But, you know, if life so have it, my mom at 34 now at the time, she was 34 at the time. She had a brain aneurysm overnight, no warning, no test, no diagnosis, no, you know, prolonged treatment before. One night, she thought she had food poisoning. I spent the night at her house, and we were so independent of each other. We were like big brother and sister almost. So like, it would be, okay, 1 month, I'll cover the rent, and she can have her check to do whatever she wants to do with. And the next month, she'd cover the rent and the phone bills. When there was garbage, it would be like, who's taking the garbage out? Okay, let's not leave this here. And so it was really, my mom allowed me to have that conversation relationship. We were both young. And I was you know, reasonably responsible as well, because debate, when I became a debater, my favorites went from Nickelodeon, MTV, to C-SPAN 1, C-SPAN 2. My allowance was MSNBC. My allowance was New York Times subscriptions in the hood. So yeah. I wasn't interested in really going outside. I was researching and cutting arguments. So she had this aneurysm, and I'm an only child on both sides, my dad's side and mom's side. So I'm the only child. And then, so yeah, I had to take all of that cool stuff I learned and now learn about the brain. And in honestly, traditionally in my family, we've never had brain injured people. And we didn't have advanced degrees where people were coming back from college and had studied psychology. That just wasn't happening in the hood. So a brain aneurysm is something we would watch a story about on, you know, Lifetime. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that we had any. So I had to stop everything and become the guardian of the person and the guardian of the estate. You have family, you know, that drama they wanted, that, you know, they fought me in court because they thought I was too young to be the guardian, but they were a little detached from who I was, because in the hood, I was one thing, but in the debate world, in the politic world, you know, I'm this super, but when you come back to the hood, you look the little boy who grew up down the street. So it was emotionally taxing. And so after that, my job let me go. They were like, listen, you need to figure some stuff out, take some time. But that doesn't mean I get to backpack through Budapest and find myself after this. No, I still, you know, that's just not the lifestyle that, so I still had to work little odd end jobs. And that's when I just lost it all. I had a condo, nice car, you know, all consistent payments and things like that. My grandmother was just moved out. So I had to really, really, really figure it out. And I got certified in critical care nursing, got certified in respiratory therapy, got certified in wound management. And I took care of my OG by myself, like with no problem. Wow. I just kind of, what else would I do? She's mine. And I know that if it was reverse, she'd do the same thing. So it was more like mom, big sister, good friend, which I don't know. Mm. I think it makes for a dope parent.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. Man. And so you've got this new change, new stuff going on. How long did this process last? And what were you kind of doing throughout this whole process?
So she survived after the aneurysm and the complications, which is more so what the issue was, for 7 years after that. So it was 7 years of, you know, not hearing good morning, baby, and having to recall memories, having to figure out how to celebrate holidays appropriately, having to make tough medical decisions, having to, you know, you can't be a crying mess. After 7 years, every doctor's appointment, you can't be in there bawling out. So you learn to dry those tears up and become a patient advocate and learn how to get on the phone with these insurance companies. And so 7 years, I was in the house. I couldn't go anywhere because by that time they were paying me and everything, so I could stay in the house. And I started renovating this foreclosed home that a friend moved out of, because I didn't have a place, but I knew she needed to be with me because the nursing homes, sadly, were really poor. And even then I knew, like, if you're not going to do it the way I want it done, then I just need to do it myself. So my friend moved out of this house. He's like, hey, this house is being foreclosed on. I'm out of here, you know. And I knew, because I was still smart under all the trauma. I was like, I know it's going to be a while before they actually come and take the house. I had no appliances, no fridge, no stove, no market, none of that. But my mom was like on tube feeding, so she didn't need a fridge anyway. So I'm like, okay, well, I gave her the master suite, set it up. It was beautiful, warm, wonderful. And I started bartering to kind of get stuff I need. So I would leave my groceries on the back porch in the cold, because this is more, you know, in the wintertime. And one time I had an iPad and $300. I got a stove. It was something else I had. I traded and got the fridge. And because it took a long time for the state to start paying me, I'll say that too. You know, it was a year almost before I started to, something was going on with the state budget and all that stuff. So wow. I had to figure it out, man. But I started renovating and YouTubing, learning how to do drywall, how to run my own electric, how to change out the light fixtures, make the best of the situation. Mm-hmm. So it was a big house. My mom had the top level. Then I had the entire basement level that was fully furnished. And so I could have friends over, and you never know my mom was upstairs. Like, it wasn't your business, you know? So
Yeah.
It's a lot to even think about, but yeah, it was an interesting time.
Definitely, dude. That's insane. That takes a certain kind of strong person that's willing to do that, but also able to continue to build themselves up along the way and learn and grow at the same time. And then afterwards, I know you kind of got involved in a church, right?
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
All throughout this time, to add even weirder. So I was already a debater in the hood who wasn't interested in anything remotely hoodish. So I was started going to a Hispanic church. And the church, which I love, oh my God, they saved me, man. The church was all Hispanic, Spanish and English. And I was one of the two African-American people there. Now, there was them dark people there at the time. And that's when I got exposed to culture. I also got exposed to family culture. They were so family oriented. And if you're doing something, you're going to eat. It doesn't matter if they're paying you to work on their house. Oh, you're going to eat, and they're going to offer you food. And so it was totally just new world for me. So here I am. I started there, and we started, and I learned Spanish and English. We were singing, and I recorded some albums with the church, Spanish and English. Could pray. I actually led prayer for a Tuesday night, like prayer service in Spanish, you know?
That's awesome.
I just thought it was an escape, and they took care of me, man. Mm-hmm. They hid.
Well, we were talking before this, and you had said that you go to church one Sunday, whatever it was, and then everyone's going out to eat afterwards, and they asked you to come along, and you didn't have money, right?
Yeah. And you didn't. I didn't have money, but I have full of pride. I'm young now. Don't think of me as, you know, Nelson Mandela by any means. I was still young and wanted to figure out how to hold on to that image of, you know, this glory days when I was high school's over. You know, that stuff nobody's. And a lot of the argumentation stuff that we used in debate wasn't applicable to regular conversations. You know, you're not walking around discussing Michel Foucault with, it's just not. So it felt like all of that stuff was non-germane anymore. So now, yeah. I had to develop, and I think that's kind of now it's termed emotional intelligence. I think that's when my emotional intelligence started to build and be defined and shaped. Working, you know, being loved on by this Hispanic church that I would go out to eat, and I would say I didn't want to go, and they would say, well, why not? You're going. And then they would just pay for my food. We would go to Great America, you know, and it's like $30. Now, it was enough for me maybe to scrounge up $5 or $10 at the church tacos. But you talk about Great America, which means rides and sundaes and funnel cakes and whoo, you talk about, you catch us around income tax time. And they just with, but without making me feel it, I didn't feel, it was like family. Mm. And that's when I kind of realized like, oh.
It wasn't like they were doing it to have one over on you and kind of put themselves above you type of deal. It was because that they truly cared about you and, yeah, and wanted you to be a part of the family.
Yeah, but my dad was a drug dealer. So everybody wants something. And my dad was also a very big proponent. He would say, no small talk. He would say, so, you know, what is it? He said, because while you're talking about the weather, his secondary guy could be sneaking up behind you, ready to cluck you in the back of the head while you're talking about birds and snow. And so he was always no small talk. And so I always kind of had that cynical eye. Then my mom, remember, my mom was 14 when she had me, 15. So I'm kind of I'm a real life young adult. I understand things really well as a young person because I kind of did it already with my mom. So when these people were being nice, and I'm just like, I hope you know, you better not try anything, or this better not be poisoned. It took a long time to get over that. Yeah. And trust, you know, people.
So where was your first kind of breakthrough into the luxury design world? And when did you kind of figure out that you had this gift in luxury designing?
Sad beginnings. So I had the memorial for my mom after she passed at this house that I had been building and working and bartering and trading. And I turned it into sort of everything that I needed. So it wasn't a big deal for me not to come out the house and come to birthday parties or other family functions because my house was simply better because I had to be here all day. So by the time the story with my mom sort of concludes, I have a baby grand piano in a piano room. I have multiple sitting rooms, living rooms, guest rooms, state-of-the-art kitchen, artwork, picture lighting, you know, because I just couldn't stand there and look at tan every day as a young person. Mm-hmm. And so I just started to look for the most unique items because if I'm going to be here for 7 years, at least the dining table can make me smile when my aunt comes over and she's like, "Woo, where'd that come from?" And you're like, "Oh, yeah, okay, I got one." So my first big break came. So the pastors from this Hispanic church, they're still in my life. They came over and they were like, "Oh, wow, this is where you live?" And I'm like, "Yeah." They're like, "Oh." So they were up for a church redesign. And they say, "Hey, you want to do the church?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I can do it." Mm-hmm. So I prepared just like I would for a debate tournament. I remembered everything that I had been learning in the house, you know, design concepts. I made a pin board. I stuck all these different ideas on there. And I said, "I'm not going to make it like you think it's going to be. Are you okay with that?" And they were like, "Yeah, we're going more modern." I'm like, "Modern? Okay." So, because, you know, this was more traditional church looking, you know, carpets, mm-hmm, and burgundies. And then they were Hispanic. So there was a lot of flowers and flower paintings and things of that nature. And I was like, I'm not going to put flowers up everywhere. And they were just like, okay. And so they let my little crazy young self, and I slept there. I ate there. I didn't need much. My mom's gone. You know, and so I was already in this sort of stay in and get it done and work through the middle of the night because after I would give her food and meds, she's out. You know, I just got to do a check-in before I go to bed, but I don't have to see her till the next morning at 6. So I was already still in that discipline of working through the night so that I can spend the time doing whatever, doctor's appointments or whatever. So I worked day and night. I designed when people went to sleep. I would find a couch, knock out, get up, do it again. Get up, you know, tell the contractors what I wanted, describe it. They couldn't figure it out. I would go on a computer and I would find it. Oh, this is what you need. You need to use the aluminum, you know? And they were like, okay. And listen, a lot of them were Mexicans and those are my brothers and sisters. And they didn't say no. They did not say no to me. And once I realized, I put the baptism pool inside the stage. I did an open space concept with a cafe in it, in a Hispanic neighborhood in the west side of Chicago. And it was well received. And so I knew then.
Wow, I knew.
Yeah, I felt it in the bottom of my feet then. Because I was used to, I'm like, and I don't have to come in this game. You got to have money. You got to have money for me to be able to really create the way I need to do my art. Mm-hmm. Everybody's not the way, but I know I might want to buy or get two couches just to compare how they're going to work in the room size-wise. But if the budget only allows me to get one, it's like, what could have been? And I want to give the absolute best. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the luxury world, they understood it. They were like, okay, just make it hot. Yeah. That's all I want to hear.
Dude, one of my favorite stories of successful people is like the way they got into their business was that they couldn't say no. Someone asked them to do something. Maybe it's, hey, do you know how to market to these type of people? Yes, I can figure it out. Do you know how to do this? How to buy apartments and real estate and build these? Yes, I can do it. But in the back of their mind, that they've never done it before. But it's one of those things where you jump out of an airplane and you learn how to land on the way down. You learn how to pull that parachute on the way down, but you still have that experience and you don't say no. So, dude, I think that's awesome. That's incredible. The best way to learn is on the job.
And I learned, you know, and it was also, it wasn't just a smooth, you know, story. I learned, I burned bridges. I offended people along my development way. I said I could do something, under-delivered sometimes, over-promised, you know, and I worked myself into, I had a hernia, a literal hernia, a negro hernia from carrying drywall and doing it myself and not budgeting properly for what I needed because I was afraid that the number might, you know, scare people. I wasn't even getting paid at some points. I would get the budget to do the renovation to pay everybody else because I just wanted the opportunity to release, you know, or to make somebody's life change. So a lot of times my number was never built into the budget. And I had a hernia from carrying everything. So the gradual journey to get to this point, if I told people what it cost, you wouldn't have paid it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have paid it either. So we're both in the same boat.
So life. What kind of people are you working with now that you've kind of had a few years under your belt, getting this thing down? What is more your clientele and who are you working with?
Sure. So we work with residential and commercial. Generally, they are high net worth individuals or corporations who understand what it is. A lot of it is similar to like family. I've never needed to have a resume. I needed to have people who knew me and vouched for me. And because I was in those circles, I understood the language, understood things that just because I wasn't school educated by an institution doesn't mean I was not educated. So I self-educated myself. I read books all that 7 years in the house. Trust me, I probably read it. And so I read, and then I, as time progressed, like even during pandemic, I took classes from Stanford Business School, Harvard Business School on edX for free. They were giving those classes away. I watch YouTube, Stanford Business School's YouTube channel, watch the lectures. I study, I just don't check in every day and do homework assignments, but the homework assignments come in the form of real interactions. There's gonna come a time where the answer to what was on that test, I'm gonna have to give it. And so in the similar sense, you know, I always tell people the school of the hard knocks is an Ivy League. Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love it, dude. Your story is unbelievable. I love the grind and what you've been through has kind of is the reason that you're doing what you are now. So moving forward now, what are kind of your plans for the future? What do you got coming up? And then what are also some of your long-term visions?
So I have a lot of cool stuff coming up. One being I was recently actually asked to have a reality show produced about my firm and what I do and myself, and which that was not a part of the plans. I never clicked on an audition link, and I was just okay with being okay, because I also understand the power of not being popular, you know, of being underestimated my entire life. There's a beautiful shade that comes with it, you know? And so I'm able to actually do more impactful things without people knowing it, which is a part of that high net worth understanding, in my opinion. I'm not saying it's universal, but in my opinion, they get, that's why a lot of donations are anonymous, and that's why they buy things in trust. And you know, I am able to do more things. So I have this reality show coming. I've been working on a product line for the last 4 years. And so it's going to be coming out, Griffin Home. And the whole goal with me is I'm going to create a luxury funnel of sorts, so that I can just change the hood myself. I'm tired of all of the stipulations and grants and all of the loopholes that have to be jumped through in order to get something to change the neighborhood. I'm there. I don't want to fight with you. I don't want to argue with you. I'll just buy the vacant lots and build affordable house. I'll just compete in the real market and make my dough and come and buy it. That's what I'll do. Because a lot of the guidelines and stipulations with all this money is not organic enough. If you give somebody $30,000 to do something in an inner city neighborhood and it's not working, they should have the ability to pivot into a world or a language that does get it done. And that's what I'm about. If something's not working, you change it. You know, doing the same thing over and over again, and everybody already knows, it's insanity. So I don't want to cause a stir. I just want to do it. If HGTV, and you remember that show, and they would go move that bus, and they would
rent. Yeah, Extreme Makeover Home Edition.
Extreme Makeover, yeah, that. And I would just think, look at all those people coming together, all those different construction companies, all these different, the neighborhoods, and they all had different businesses. And they all would donate and send the family on a vacation or whatever and get this thing done fast. They come back and they move that bus. How does that work in one instance on a micro level, but can't, you know, function on a macro level? And I'm not even trying to go there on a macro level. I'm gonna stay in my lane, my neighborhood, my blocks, where I'll fix them.
So what do you think needs changing? What kind of things are you looking to get into and transform?
So definitely it's the, for me as being an artist, being a designer, I look at the facades and the buildings and the homes that are built, and I don't think they reflect the Wakanda, if I can give you. So it doesn't reflect Wakanda. And when you watch Black Panther and that movie and everybody's so enamored with the city, it's so interesting how progression and the new, it's never that, but you never ask. Or you think that only the people with these advanced degrees understand by studying us from a book, but you can't. There's a spirit, there's an essence that comes with our neighborhoods in these areas that are predominantly Black or with people of color. And I think that needs to be reflected in the new Starbucks design. I love modern. I love Frank Lloyd Wright. I'm an architect. I love what I do, but I do also understand adaptation for different environments. And so when little Black kids are on the school bus driving past and you see a beautifully designed building or something that stands out, they go, oh my God, I wonder what that is. Or it just brings up people's expectations, keeping the landscape and the trees in the hood nice and manicured. It does something to people when they're coming home from a late night shift nursing job, and they can look up and see the downtown Chicago, because you can't see it that clearly. But in a lot of our neighborhoods, you see the bushes just unkept and they kind of cloud over the view. That little glimpse might make a person like me say, hold on a little bit, or I'm driving, taking a drive, I'm sad by my mom. You never know who is being impacted by your designs and by your, so I just don't want to make a campaign about it. I just want to do it. I don't want to talk to him.
That's awesome. I love that. The heart of gold that you have and how it kind of goes together with God's vision and purpose for your life is so cool to see. And I'm excited to see what's coming and keep following along with your story, dude. I'm so pumped for you in the future. So I've got a few questions I always ask at the end of my interview. What is a book that kind of transformed either the way you think or just something that you would recommend to people my age?
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm trying to see which one I'm going to give you because I want to be politically correct.
Give two. But give two. Give them all.
So one is this. It's a newer book, and this is by Chris Voss. And the name of the book is Never Split the Difference.
Oh, and dude.
Are you Chris Voss? Okay. So Never Split the Difference was really good for me just right on this tail end of my development because, yeah, you're going to run me my dough all up front or not. Or not. So that's one. And then my other... Man, it's probably going to be because I'm going through Wharton. What is this Wharton? I think it's the Art of Strategy. And I think this is the Art of Strategy, and it's a Wharton book, but it's like this thick. And, it breaks down strategies of like some of the really big conglomerates of the world, the Chases of the world, the names that are, you know, oil tycoons. And I think he talks about just sort of the abstract theories that they used or that was formulated as they went through creating businesses. And something that's important to me is legacy. You know, like I want my kids, my grandkids they just kind of have it easier. So
yeah,
with that, so I'm always interested in the mindset. I don't really care about what a lot of people are talking about. I care about what they're disciplined in doing because I know that's what it takes. And so even with art, it is the intellect that manages the gift. And so a lot of artists, I think, are not even going as deep as they could because they won't read a book.
If you had to give one piece of advice to someone just coming out of school, looking back, what would you tell that person? Whether it's they're coming out of high school or college, someone that's coming into the real world, what kind of advice can you give?
I would say if you have that time where it's kind of like a limbo time, you should hide yourself almost. You need to become accustomed with yourself and what you do in different scenarios, but with yourself. And I would say, and so in that moment, you're sort of learning how to do things by yourself. And I know this sounds, you know, different than a lot of other people's advice, because I think that when you learn how to do things by yourself, it's easier to learn how to work in a team. Because I know how I respond to certain things. And so I put people in positions there so that I can lower the threshold of killing the deal, you know, being disrespectful, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I would say take that time to really like sabbatical almost, where you're just thinking about yourself and the world and you're developing what this all is doing, right? You're learning what to do when you're by yourself and something sad happens. You're learning what to do and what you do when you're upset and you're in the house by yourself and you get some horrible news or something happens. You learn what to do. How do you celebrate when you're extremely happy by yourself? You know how you celebrate your birthday when you're out at the club with a ton of people and the music's booming. And once you figure out how to do those things, how to celebrate yourself, how to correct yourself, how to examine your heart, how do I apologize? How do I... Just do it. Just make the phone call. Just take that time. Develop your emotional intelligence. You can be smart, but if you don't have the emotional IQ, it's going to be a lot harder. I'll say that, especially if you are a person of color.
That's awesome. I appreciate that advice. One of my favorite sayings is that in order for you to be able to lead someone else or lead a team, you have to be able to lead yourself first and know yourself and know what you're good at and know what you're not good at. That way you can bring people around you that are good at what you're not good at and fill those gaps.
If you want to do graphics, that's please let me help you do graphics. If you want to do and you have a love for painting, I can paint, but please let me allow you. And so replicating myself is for me, it's the part of leadership, because if this formula, if this algorithm that I'm talking about so passionately right now works or is working for me, then other people should be able to take this formula, the same vaccine or whatever, and get similar, close to or better results. I don't want Wikipedia to say I'm just this cool black rich guy. I want to say that everybody who came around him, worked with him, did the same thing. And so that little part.
And kind of leaves being with you, being inspired and walks away inspired because of your greatness and the great things that you pour into him. And I know anyone listening to this too is going to feel the same way from this story. So my last question is success. The word success, what does that mean to you? When you get to the end of your life and you're looking back, what is it going to take to be able to say I was successful in this life?
I think I'm gonna just definitely say I want to leave this earth poured out. It's weird to me that people go through so much work to make themselves wonderful. You go through so much work to make yourself deep and smart, intellectual, emotional. You don't share with anybody. Like you keep all your gifts, talents, ideas. You keep it all to yourself. All this therapy you're going, all these things you figured out about the world, you keep to yourself so that you can take it with you. So I think success for me is just going to be, during my life, continuing to hear God. That's success to me. Like my success is right now in the moment and being able to hear when he says don't, hearing when he says do it faster, hearing when he says stop, go further, talk to this person, Uber driver, send her a Cash App randomly, whatever it is. If I can keep that throughout my whole life till I expire, I'm successful. If you like me afterwards or during, amen. But yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Griffin, this was so much fun. This was unbelievable. I love your story. I know people are going to get so much out of it too. Where can people find you on social media? What are your tags? How can we get a hold of you and watch your story?
Everything is Griffin Direction. So the name of my design firm is Griffin Direction Interiors. And, Instagram is Griffin Direction. And there, I have websites and all that stuff. But on my Instagram, that one's the organic feed. I don't let people post for me or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be real. And in my stories, that's where you get the daily, like the good, because in the actual post, it's okay. But the stories is where it's organic.
Yeah, absolutely. Griffin, this was fun. I appreciate it. Anyone listening, go follow Griffin on Instagram, be inspired. His story is one of the best I've ever heard. I love it, brother. I appreciate it. Thanks for sitting down with me.
No, thank you. I love it. I haven't really talked much because I've been a real doer type of person, but now I'm starting to talk. So I'm happy that you're doing what you're doing. So you got to do what you do so that I can do what I do. That's what we're here for. You got to do what you're supposed to do because somebody else needs it. Not necessarily just because of you, but it's going to make you cool, but because somebody somewhere down the line might get this podcast 20 years from now and not do something or hold on a little bit longer. So being able to hear.
Absolutely. Well, I promise anyone listening 20 years from now is going to be inspired by you and your story. So I appreciate it. Thanks, Griffin.
Brother.
Man, what an awesome story and an even better dude. The things he's been through to get him to where he is today is remarkable. The outlook that he's got on life and the attention to detail is what really stands out to me. things as small as trimming the trees in the ghetto so you can see the city line and see that skyline and be inspired on your way home from work. Unbelievable. Guys, if you haven't yet, be sure to go follow the podcast. Follow me on social media. Got some great things happening there. And until next week, thank you for coming along on this journey with me of uncovering success.